Money Radio, thank you so much for joining us today. And joining us now, it's a pleasure to welcome Helen Chaitman. She is co-author, along with Lance Gotthoffer, of a new book, J.P. Madoff, The Unholy Alliance Between America's Biggest Bank and America's Biggest Crook, J.P. Madoff. Helen, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
And of course, J.P. Madoff, we're talking of a combination, a mix there between J.P. Morgan Chase and Bernie Madoff. And as it turns out, they had a very unique relationship over the years. First off, though, tell us a little bit about how you got involved in this story.
Sure. I was brilliant enough to have put all my liquid assets in Madoff on the advice of a cousin who had only my best interests at heart and genuinely believed everything he'd read about Madoff and who had invested himself. And after Madoff confessed on December 11, 2008, I was a bit depressed, and that was the coincidence of not only losing my life savings, but also my law practice had come to a virtual halt because I specialize in litigation involving financial institutions. And as your listeners will recall, in December 2008, financial institutions were not in good shape, and the last thing they were doing was spending money on litigation. So I lost my life savings, and I had a temporary loss of complete loss of my income. And at that point in time, I decided, well, I might as well do something good for somebody, and I let it be known that I would provide free advice to Madoff victims, not on legal issues, but on life issues. And I operated a kind of 24-hour hotline on my cell phone. And gradually, I began to understand some of the issues that I felt I could help Madoff victims with. One of them was a clarification of the theft loss under the Internal Revenue Code. And I picked myself up and actually went to Washington, and along with a number of other people, was effective in getting the Internal Revenue Service to put out a revenue procedure ruling, which allowed Madoff victims to apply for a theft loss and get a tax refund within 45 days of mailing their application, equivalent to the last 5 years of taxes they had paid on what they thought was the income on their Madoff account. And in the process, I became known as a spokesperson for the Madoff victims. And after Bernie Madoff was imprisoned, I got a phone call one day while I was walking down Lexington Avenue in New York, and the voice said, "Hello, Helen, this is Ruth Madoff." Now, I had never met Ruth Madoff, and in fact, I had never met or spoken with Bernie Madoff. But Ruth said, "Helen, Bernie wants to speak to you." And I said, "Well, how do we arrange that?" And she said, "Well, he can call you collect from prison tomorrow if you give me a number. It had to be a landline." And that set in motion a series of maybe even 50 phone calls that I've had with Madoff over the years. And the first thing that he said to me in my very first conversation was that J.P. Morgan Chase knew all along what he was doing. And when he first said it to me, I thought, that's crazy. But he was 100% right. The facts have borne out that not only did J.P. Morgan Chase know for 20 years that he was committing crimes, but they deliberately set the account up in a way so that they could profit from it. And in the meantime, 35,000 people lost $64.8
billion. $64.8 billion. It's a lot of money. I don't know if it makes Madoff America's biggest crook, but he's right up there, that's for sure. Meanwhile, this alliance between J.P. Morgan Chase and Madoff, why would a bank like J.P. Morgan Chase become involved with someone like Madoff? And as you say, this went on for many years. At some point or another, and you detail in the book, it became quite obvious that Madoff was not running a regular company, that his transactions were highly unusual. This should have been something that they spotted quite easily, and indeed they did, but they just kept going. Why would they do that?
They would do it to generate profits. On my website, jpmadoff.com, I have in the center of the homepage a roulette wheel, which shows that just in the last 5 years, J.P. Morgan Chase has paid $36 billion in fines, penalties, and damages to people that it defrauded. It didn't matter whether you were a veteran fighting in Iraq. It didn't matter if you were a consumer. It didn't matter if you had a trust that you made J.P. Morgan Chase the trustee of. J.P. Morgan Chase has become an institution like the mob, which makes money by violating the law. Just in the last 3 years, they have pled guilty to three felonies, two with respect to the Madoff account, and one with respect to manipulation of LIBOR, the London interbank rate. But they've committed other crimes, and the government is so sympathetic to financial institutions, regardless of whether they commit crimes, that some of the crimes are resolved without requiring J.P. Morgan Chase to actually plead guilty to a felony. But three felonies in 3 years is a pretty outrageous record for America's largest bank.
So in the case of Madoff, they just felt, well, we'll get away with it. There's nothing that will happen to us. There will be no particular consequences other than perhaps a fine. They're looking at it saying that's our worst-case scenario, based upon a pretty long track history of that being the worst case scenario. And so they just don't care. They break the law. And by the way, the fines are typically paid by shareholders.
The fines are paid by shareholders, but of course the shareholders enjoy the profits as well. And just as the Gambino crime family figured out how to make money by breaking the law, the thesis of my book is that J.P. Morgan Chase has done the same thing. And there's a cost of doing business. The cost of doing business includes the massive amount of money that's paid in political contributions, which someone could look at and say these are essentially bribes. Why did the Obama administration adopt a policy of not putting a single criminal banker in jail when Obama was president during a period where there has been a massive amount of criminal conduct among Wall Street institutions? And the very sad irony of this is that if you have a young kid who robs a 7-Eleven of $300, he goes to jail. But if you have a prominent Wall Street banker who sets up a scheme which injures people to the extent of billions of dollars, he just goes to Greenwich in his limousine. And yet, if you put one of those people in jail, it would have a ripple effect on Wall Street. It would truly serve a deterrent purpose, because the one thing Wall Street banksters have not yet figured out how to do is how to pay someone else to serve their prison sentences. And it's very sad, because the victimization of the public is very subtle. Most people have no idea that they're being victimized, because it's too complicated for them to read all the small print. And if J.P. Morgan Chase steals a little bit of money from millions of different people, they just don't realize it. But the bank is violating the law. And it's a little bit like a fox hunt, where you don't catch the fox. Every day, J.P. Morgan Chase is figuring out a new way to take advantage of people. And the law doesn't catch up with this. And unless you take the criminal bankers and put them in prison, this will not end.
J.P. Morgan has been found guilty, as you say, of criminal conduct with regard to the Madoff case. That dealt with bank secrecy laws. And there's also been, as you mentioned, the LIBOR case. But there is a long, long list of wrongdoing. And in this case, we're looking at deferred prosecution agreements, correct?
Yes.
Which basically means, think of it as somebody gets probation and the judge says, okay, don't break the law again, otherwise you will violate your probation, in which case you'll be thrown in jail. However, in deferred prosecution agreements, it seems as if they basically put them on probation, but then they never follow up, because there have been repeated wrongdoing even after they've been dealt with deferred prosecution agreements. That just seems mind-boggling.
Well, it is mind-boggling, and the only explanation is that the government has given get-out-of-jail-free cards to everyone on Wall Street. Because, for example, there has been an investigation going on for several years now into J.P. Morgan Chase's hiring of the children of prominent Chinese government officials in order to enhance J.P. Morgan Chase's percentage of the banking business that's available in China. Now, in one instance, Jamie Dimon actually flew to Hong Kong to interview one of these children. There has not yet been an indictment. And, of course, the government has complete discretion whether to indict. And as you say, that indictment would trigger a violation of these other deferred prosecution agreements. So we have a situation where the biggest white-collar criminals in the country have the ability to negotiate with the government and to avoid enforcement of the law. And you mentioned the Bank Secrecy Act. I think it's important for people to understand that in 1970, at a time when Wall Street did not control Congress, the government reached the conclusion that in order to prevent criminalization of our financial institutions, we had to place the banks in a position where they were going to assist the government in ferreting out financial crimes, because just as Madoff needed a major bank behind him, any financial fraud requires the use of a bank. So the Bank Secrecy Act imposes upon banks an affirmative obligation to understand their customers. It's called the Know Your Customer policy. You have an affirmative obligation to understand what your customer's business is, what his typical cash flow is, so that if there are unusual transactions in the account, you can immediately investigate them. And if you find suspicious activity, you have an obligation to close the account and inform the federal government. Now, it's indisputable that in 1994, J.P. Morgan Chase, which was then Chemical Bank, identified clear criminal activity in Madoff's account for his investment advisory business, which was at J.P. Morgan Chase. And instead of closing the account, they just wanted to make sure that they wouldn't lose money on the transaction. But when you think about it, a bank has a glass-bottom boat view of everything that goes on in an account. They were able to see exactly who Madoff's customers were, that it was an upstate New York pension fund that was investing its workers' money in Madoff. It might have been a university. It might have been a charity. They could see the money coming in, and they also saw what happened to the money. Now, most of the money that went out went to Madoff's big co-conspirators, primarily Jeffrey Pickhauer, who took out $7.8 billion after making an investment of only $650 million. But a lot of the money stayed on deposit in the bank. And, of course, that was the bribe. That was the payoff for J.P. Morgan Chase. I remember the days when you'd get a toaster if you opened a bank account in a New York bank with a $5,000 deposit. Well, what do you get if you leave $3 to $6 billion on deposit, which is what Madoff did in the period from, say, 2003 to 2007? It's inconceivable that any legitimate investment advisor would leave billions of dollars on deposit in a bank. It was a clear bribe to the bank.
Yeah, the case against J.P. Morgan is laid out very convincingly in the new book, J.P. Madoff, by Helen Chaitman and Lance Guthoffer. And the website is jpmadoff.com. We will dig into this case a little bit more as we continue our conversation with Helen Chaitman. Money Radio, thank you so much for joining us today. We're talking with Helen Chaitman. She is a co-author of a new book, J.P. Madoff, The Case of Bernie Madoff, The Ponzi Scheme, $65 billion Lost, and The Alliance Between Madoff and J.P. Morgan Chase. In the book, J.P. Madoff, the case is laid out very, very clearly. You also have a website, jpmadoff.com. It's almost impossible to imagine that if Eric Holder or Loretta Lynch or Preet Bharara from New York, that they could not look at this and say, well, clearly this is reason to indict. Clearly this is reason to charge. Clearly there is illegal activity. And the more you look at it, and it's not just the Madoff case, as you say, you've got a whole wheel of wrongdoing that can be attributed to J.P. Morgan Chase, over $36 billion in fines, but nobody goes to jail. I want to go to a quote that you had early in the book. Every society gets the kind of criminal it deserves. What is equally true is that every community gets the kind of law enforcement it insists on. It's a quote from Robert Kennedy. What can we as individuals do at this point?
I love that quote from Robert Kennedy, and I think that it puts the responsibility on the American people. I think people have to stand up and demand that people other than the super rich who benefit from these kinds of schemes are protected. And unfortunately, in the Obama administration, they haven't been protected at all. And unfortunately, if you track the money, if you go to OpenSecrets.com and look, for example, at the political contributions that were given to Obama, at the political contributions that were given to Senator Schumer, who is the senior senator from New York, and Preet Bharara was his chief counsel before he became U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, you see a pattern here. Eric Holder had been at Covington & Burling, which represents J.P. Morgan Chase, before he became attorney general. And guess where he is now? He went right back to Covington and Burling, where he continues to represent J.P. Morgan Chase. The American people have to stand up and say, this is not right, and we're not going to elect officials who sell their souls to Wall Street or to some other major contributor. The responsibility lies with the people, but they have to understand the facts. And that's precisely why we wrote this book.
This does go back to that too-big-to-fail doctrine that came about under Eric Holder, which goes back, I guess, probably to the days of Enron and the collateral damage of Arthur Andersen.
You know, I find Eric Holder's theory so disgraceful. It's almost embarrassing that someone who was a public servant would articulate a theory like that. In other words, he can't prosecute criminals at J.P. Morgan Chase because the economy is too dependent upon J.P. Morgan Chase. So in other words, we need the few criminal bankers who were involved in any specific crime. The entire organization of 240,000 employees would collapse because you put three people in jail. Hmm. It's preposterous.
Very quickly, Helen.
If that's the case.
Before we run out of time here, very quickly, where does this stand for the victims of Madoff?
There's been virtually a de minimis recovery. The total loss for 35,000 people was $64.8 billion. Approximately $10 billion has been recovered. So it's basically 16%.
Mm. This is an important book. It should be read by prosecutors across the country. It should be read by investors everywhere. And by voters, for that matter. J.P. Madoff, the website jpmadoff.com, the book J.P. Madoff by Lance Gotthoffer, and our guest today, Helen Chaitman. Thank you so much for putting this together, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.